Good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us this evening a very special guest. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Buzz Patterson, and he, well, he has an amazing, amazing story to tell about his time working in the White House with President Clinton, and of course all the amazing things that happened when we were there. Colonel Patterson, are you there?
Good evening, sir. How are you doing?
Well, it's good to have you with us again. And, of course, Colonel Patterson has written a fascinating book called Dereliction of Duty, going into what he personally witnessed when he was assigned to be with the president literally all the time, or a great deal of the time. He carried the football. Now, we saw some pictures the other night of the football. It looked like sort of a little suitcase. Is that it?
It's actually a large black satchel, Dr. Stan. It's very heavy. It weighs about 45 pounds. It's a large black briefcase that accompanies the president no matter where he goes, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it's carried by a military aide by his side at all times. And it's one large black briefcase with a black leather covering on it.
All right, fine. And of course, this is really one of the most important jobs in the entire country. Why don't you explain to our listeners why the man who carries the football may well carry the responsibility for the entire country on his shoulders?
Yes, sir. Well, ever since President Eisenhower, actually, Dr. Stan, has been a military aide by the president's side 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, carrying this large satchel. And it's the means by which the president can make decisions regarding nuclear weapons and communicating those decisions with the Pentagon, through his military aide, to make decisions about either launch military or nuclear weapons or retaliate with nuclear weapons in the event that should be necessary. And that very primary responsibility has been by the president ever since President Eisenhower, actually.
In other words, if the enemy were to launch a nuclear attack on America, and of course what they would do would be probably to target, at least in large part, many of the weapons we have in the ground, because if they could knock out our ability to retaliate against them, they would have won the war, we would have lost the war, and as terrible as war is, there's only one thing worse than fighting a war, and that's losing a war.
Yes, sir.
And, of course, the whole idea would be the president then would have to make the decision as to whether to launch on a notification, which would mean that when the Soviet missiles arrived here, there wouldn't be anything in the silos, or to leave them there so where they're to be destroyed. And so, and certainly the fact that we base our military defense on this concept of mutual assured destruction, MAD, means that the president has to be ready at all times to respond if indeed there is a nuclear attack or
right.
A threat of a nuclear attack on America. So why? What happened when the president lost the codes by which he would be able to respond?
Well, President Clinton actually lost those codes in 1998, which was the first time in our history the president has lost those codes. And they're a credit card-sized document, Dr. Stan, the president's carried with him on his person at all times, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And President Clinton lost those codes during the Monica Lewinsky situation in 1998. And what was most alarming to me was the fact that he had lost the codes, number one, but also that he couldn't recall how long they'd been misplaced. So there was no way of us knowing if it had been weeks, days, months, possibly up to a year, where we had not the capability to retaliate with nuclear weapons.
And so basically, under those circumstances, everything that you were doing, everything that the Strategic Command was doing, everything that the people who man our silos across America, were really of no earthly use with the president, who wasn't even concerned enough about the importance of his job to make sure he had the nuclear codes.
That's right. I think it goes to his lack of focus and his responsibilities as our commander-in-chief. When you think about the fact that maybe this is the most important military document in the history of mankind, possibly, and the president lost those codes and didn't relate to us, his military aide, that he had lost them. And I think there was a time there where it could have fallen in the wrong hands, possibly the Chinese, possibly the North Koreans, possibly the Russians. we didn't have the ability at that point in time, not knowing that they'd been lost, to recover from that, and it could have been very, very devastating in our country's history.
What could the Russians or the Chinese have done if they had the codes?
Well, I think more than anything else, number one, they would have had the process that we use to identify the president in our system and actually launch the nuclear weapons, and I think that, to me, it was probably more alarming than the fact that he had lost the codes, that there was possibly an insight given to our enemies, that there was a glimpse into our process and how we actually alert and launch the nuclear weapons. And that, to me, was more troubling than the fact that he had lost the codes. That there was maybe, we were tipping our hand, as it were, to how our process works.
Well, of course, you know, I'm sure you're well aware of the fact that President Clinton had written an executive order that if we were to attack, we were to be attacked, we would not respond. We would absorb the first strike. In other words, we'd let them take out all of our nuclear weapons, all that they could. And then, at that point, he would respond. But, of course, he didn't have the code, so he couldn't respond.
Right. And that's a very crucial point, Dr. Stan. When that happened, when he issued that presidential directive back in 1998, he had not consulted with the Pentagon or the military aides, and we were not aware of the fact that he had actually issued that decision whereby we would not launch weapons in response. So, again, I think a little bit of lack of foresight on his part and also a lack of coordination on our part that he did not tell us that was the new policy.
Well, how did the people who worked with him, the military officers, feel about his sort of lack of concern about the protection of the American people?
Well, we were, you know, we were all troubled, and I think I would tell you that I walked in the job very wide-eyed and unaware and a little bit naive when I walked in the door in 1996, and I learned very quickly over my 2 years there that the president did not have the focus on national defense or national security interests, and especially in the military. And we learned very gradually but very consistently that he didn't have the focus and that he needed to have. And as military officers, all serving him very loyally and very devotedly, we realized that he didn't have the focus on the ball, and he didn't have that as his primary intent. And we were disillusioned and disappointed. And I will tell you, 2 years back, I looked at the job 2 years later, I was very, very unhappy with what I saw there and very disillusioned and disappointed.
Well, now, first, let's give a little of your background. You were a career Air Force officer. You flew, what sort of planes did you fly?
I flew C-141s, which are large transports. I flew them in places like Grenada and Somalia and Bosnia and Haiti and Rwanda.
And, of course, then, how was it that here you are, you're, what, pushing 20 years in the Air Force, and you are, of course, called and asked if you would want this job. Now, this is one of the most sought-after jobs, you know, in the entire nation. So why don't you pick up the story? What happened? How did you happen to be picked to have this job? There's only one Air Force officer in the entire country at any one time who has that. That's a pretty important job, isn't it, in the Air Force?
Absolutely. A great question, Dr. Stan. Actually, they selected me. I was flying airplanes for the Air Force in Northern California, very happily doing so, and had just come back from a deployment to Bosnia, where I was delivering medicine and food to the people of Sarajevo prior to the Dayton Peace Accords. I got a phone call from the White House asking me to come out and interview for this position, and not knowing that it really existed. So I went to Washington, D.C., and after a very extensive two-day interview process, was offered the job to be the president's military aide.
And of course, this was not something you sought, but you certainly, when they offered it to you, you weren't going to turn down the opportunity.
Absolutely not. And I was very privileged and honored to be offered the chance to do that. And of course, there was a very quick spin-up, couple weeks of coordination and training, and I was carrying the football about 2 weeks later, and it happened to be going into the re-election campaign in 1996, and a very busy time in the White House and President Clinton's life, and I was very excited to be there.
Well, of course, this is 1996, and of course, this is the year that TWA 800 went down. I guess it was somewhere in July of that year. And of course, now there are, four military officers, each one is with, does this for what, 24 hours or so?
Right, we rotate a duty 24 hours a day for every 4 days, and we also rotated assignments on the road where we go out in advance of the president and and prepare his trip sites and do all the logistics that were required to have the president visit places across the world, across the country. And so it's a very busy job and a lot of travel involved. But you're right, it was during the summer of 96, and TWA header went down that July, and a very busy time.
Well, of course, many people wonder what the White House knew in July of 1996 about the shooting down of TW-800, and there's a great deal of evidence from many, many sources that we've never been told the truth. In fact, that it may well have been our own missiles that shot the plane down. But what was going on in the White House at that time? Were you privy to any of the conferences? Were there any special conferences that took place at that time where you were excluded, even though you were supposed to be with the president or very close by all the time?
Well, actually, Dr. Stan, I was in the White House the night the airplane went down, and I recall, and I've talked to Jack Cashel, who's written a great book about that shoot down of TW-800. I believe it was a shoot down personally, and I recall during those times that we were giving the president a lot of intelligence about the Operation Bojinka, and which was the Al-Qaeda operation to use commercial airplanes as flying weapons.
Now, wait a minute. This is 1996. This is 5 years before the attack on the World Trade Center.
That's right.
And they had information there on Operation Bojinka, which had come out of the Philippines in 1995, about the plan of the Al-Qaeda terrorists to hijack our planes and crash them into the World Trade Center. And they had that information there in the White House in 1996 when you were there?
Yes, sir. I recall seeing One of the duties of the military aide is to bring the president his daily briefings in the morning, which are highly classified. And I recall one day in late July, early August, that the president was asking for information on Operation Bojinka, which happened to be the use of commercial airliners as flying bombs. And as an Air Force pilot, that caught my attention, obviously, and I was asked to take some notes back down to the Situation Room in the White House and give them to Mr. Sandy Berger, and I did that, but it caught my eye that we were looking at the intelligence that revolved around the fact that Al-Qaeda was talking about using commercial airliners as flying bombs. And that happened to be right around the time that TWA was shot down or went down over New York. My connection with that is that it occurred, the actual crashing of 800 occurred, and 2 days later, the president was asking for a lot of intelligence about Bojinka and what that meant to Al-Qaeda and what that meant to us as far as using commercial airliners as flying bombs. And my connection is that I think we knew about it. I think that it may have been shot down by inadvertently by our own people, and that's Jack Cashel's philosophy anyway. I think it's pretty credible, actually.
And for our listeners out there, if you have not yet seen the video Silence that Jack Cashel actually produced, you really need to. We do carry that. And it's such an important part of history because it shows the hearings before the National Traffic Safety Board, and where they have a government official get up and tell you what the various witnesses who saw what happened that night, and he tells you what they said. The only trouble is then, of course, Cashel in interviews, the witnesses were quoted, and the man, the government official, who was sitting there on camera, was lying. And that's, of course, why CNN twice invited Jack Cashel to be on their program and twice canceled the day of the program, because the last thing that they want is for the American people to learn the truth about what really happened to TW-800. Well, anyway, I think that's fascinating that Bill Clinton had information on Operation Bojinka, the plan to hijack our planes and crash them into our buildings in 1996, and yet, of course, 5 days after the attack on the World Trade Center in September of the year 2001. Dick Cheney said, well, we knew there was going to be an attack, but who could ever have possibly thought that they would take our planes and crash them into our buildings? And yet, of course, maybe Bill Clinton just didn't tell anybody about that. Maybe that's what happened. Be that as it may, I'm sure that there was a lot of concern in the White House about this. And were they holding secret meetings at that time that you were excluded from? I'm talking immediately after TWA 800 went down.
Yes, sir. I wasn't invited to many of the meetings actually that occurred in the Situation Room. I was invited to some, but most of the time, if it was something that didn't involve me personally, I would be relegated to my office in the East Wing and or my bedroom in the East Wing basement and would not be invited. So there were several of those meetings that occurred during that time frame that I was not invited to.
Well, now, what about the football? Who was close to the president with the football at that time?
I would be, but it was the requirement there, Dr. Stan, was to be within 100 yards at all times. So I could be in the East Wing and away from the meetings, but still be within the close beck and call from the president.
Okay, fine. So 100 yards, you can make a 100-yard dash pretty quick then, I'm sure, if you had to.
I used to be able to.
Well, anyway, of course, but there are many other fascinating experiences that you recount in your book. And ladies and gentlemen, the book is Dereliction of Duty. And as you, of course, read the book through, there's one story. Apparently, at one time, Saddam Hussein had attacked the Kurds. I don't know whether this is when he used the gas. What were the circumstances that we were going to retaliate against Saddam Hussein? Would you like to tell that story? The background of exactly what happened, and then, of course, how you were put right into the middle between Sandy Berger and the president?
Yes, sir. This was in 1996, in the summer of 1996, actually, and I'd been in the job about 3 months, and this is my first real insight into the man that was our commander-in-chief, and we were supporting the Kurds. We actually were encouraging the Kurds to uprise and overthrow Saddam Hussein, And they were doing that, and Saddam wants a very aggressive attack in the north to suppress the Kurdish uprising. And we, the U.S., had sent fighters and bombers to the region to retaliate and suppress Saddam's aggression. And the president had ordered this, and he was ready to pull the trigger. And this day found us at a golf tournament in Manassas, Virginia. And he was, we were, as a country, poised to launch this attack. And I as a military, were receiving phone calls from Sandy Berger trying to elicit through me the go-ahead from the president to launch the attack. On three occasions, Dr. Stan, Sandy Berger called me and said, I need the go-ahead from the president to launch the attack. We have fighters and bombers in the air over the Persian Gulf ready to launch the attack. And on three occasions, the president rebuffed my advances. I explained to him the circumstances and the criticality of the situation and the time constraints, and he couldn't be bothered. He wanted to watch the golf tournament, and on three occasions rebuffed me and said he'd get back to Berger later on. What this meant essentially was that the strike got canceled through the indecision of the president, and Berger was upset, and I was upset, and it was my first insight into the man we had elected as our commander-in-chief and the fact that he could not make decisions as our commander when he counted.
And, of course, here he is. I mean, you've got your planes in the air, you've got your bombers in the air, and here's the President of the United States consumed with the golf game, or maybe even not consumed with the golf game. Maybe he just can't make up his mind, and it's better to do nothing than perhaps leave himself open to criticism. And so nothing happens.
That's right. And I think what bothered me more, Dr. Stan, was the fact that more so than he not making a decision to launch, was that he made no decision. And he would not make a decision, nor would he take a phone call from his security advisor, which I thought was derelict in his duty, and I think that really, to me, spoke volumes, that he wouldn't make a decision at all.
Did he ever talk to you about that or mention that afterwards, or you ever talked to Sandy Berger about that? I'm sure Berger must have been furious with you for not being able to get the response.
Well, there was some postpartum there that we headed back to the White House. I talked to Berger and explained the situation to Berger, and he was upset and angry at me, and I talked to the president, and he kept deferring the decision and telling me he'd get back to Berger later on. The phone call eventually happened between him and Berger, I think, en route back to the White House, but it was much too late at that point in time. It was daylight over in the Persian Gulf, and so I was the brunt of both their anger, and I felt the frustration of Sandy Berger. I knew those were my peers in those cockpits flying, and I knew what they were going through, and I felt their angst and the fact that there was no decision made and possibly their lives being taken, or people's lives being taken on the ground in Iraq, and it was an indecisive moment in President Clinton's career as our commander-in-chief, and I think a very poor one.
Did you see other examples of this inability to make a major decision when it was an important decision for the safety of our country?
Absolutely, and I think maybe even more importantly, Dr. Stan, was when we had Osama bin Laden, identified in 1998 as being the chief mastermind behind Al-Qaeda. We knew he was related to the terrorist attacks on Americans abroad, going back to Mogadishu, Somalia, the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, and the embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. And the president had, the U.S. had bin Laden located and identified in a Tomahawk missile strike plan to eliminate him. And Berger again was in the Situation Room trying to get the president on the line to make a decision to launch missiles against bin Laden. And for 2 hours, the president was A, unavailable, and then B, would not make a decision. He wanted to debate the issue with Berger and with his Secretary of Defense, and would not make the decision to launch the Tomahawk missiles. And I think, you know, of course, now knowing what we know about 9/11, history could have been different. But we didn't pull the trigger at that point in time, and that was a big mistake.
But of course, in 1996, the Sudanese government had offered to turn bin Laden over
to
us.
Right.
And of course, what is so incredible is we knew at that time that the whole attack, Black Hawk Down attack in Somalia, had been planned by bin Laden and his right-hand man, al-Zawahiri. We knew that bin Laden was behind the attack on the Riyadh in 1995. I mean, we knew he declared war on America. And yet, the Sudanese government says, here he is, and Bill Clinton says, for whatever reason that would be, we don't want him. But here in 1998, now he's already, he's been responsible for the bombing of the Khobar Towers in 1996,
right.
The bombing of our embassy in 19, was that before or after the bombing of the embassy in 98, do you remember?
It was after.
So he's already killed a lot of Americans, and I don't know, hundreds of people in Africa, and here's a chance to take out the wicked Osama bin Laden. And what does Bill Clinton do? What was his response? Did he ever talk, or did he ever express any feeling? Well, gee, maybe we should have done something, or I didn't want to do something, or I was worried about launching an attack on a sovereign nation. Well, actually, it wasn't too long. No, I guess it was sometime after that he hit the aspirin factory in the Sudan. But then that was a very important thing because I think that Monica Lewinsky was appearing before Congress in
that
day.
That's right.
Did he ever express any opinion to you or anybody else as to why he didn't want to take out this mass murder in 1998?
You know, at the time, Dr. Stan, he would intimate that he didn't have enough intelligence to arrest the man. He wanted to treat bin Laden as a common criminal, and he wanted to handle terrorism in the law enforcement circles and in the court of law. And I've heard him since say, since he left the office, that he regretted not making those decisions, and he regretted not making or not taking bin Laden into custody. But I think at the time he was naive to the situation, naive to the threat, and he believed bin Laden to be a common criminal and not a terrorist that could inflict harm on the U.S. And I think he was mistaken.
Well, that's very charitable of you. Anyway, let's get into some of the other things now. One of the key figures in the White House when you were there was a woman named Hillary Clinton.
Yes, ma'am.
Who, of course, may very well be running for the presidency in the year 2004. Now, what was your opinion of Hillary, and what was her relationship to the White House staff?
Well, great question, Dr. Stan. Hillary is a very complex lady. I will tell you that she gives you the public veneer of being very contrite and composed and calm and collected. And behind the scenes, she is very aggressive, very profane, very involved, all-knowing, omnipotent. She's in my time there, she ran the White House. She was a co-president. She was intimately involved in all that was going on behind the scenes, and I saw her on several occasions take control of the White House, take control of the president, in no uncertain terms, run the show, drive the schedule, and in a very vulgar and profane language, put the president in his place. And it was embarrassing to me for the president from time to time, and also embarrassing to me for the staff, because she could be very directive and overtly so, and very strong personality, very intelligent, but also, I think, very misguided and prone to fits of fury.
Now, Trish, now, one of the things that you write, no, you didn't necessarily, yes, you did write this in your book. You know, when I read so many books on the White House, but you wrote something very, very similar to what Gary Aldridge had written in his book, Unlimited Access. And that is that, you know, if you were walking down the hall and you saw that Hillary was coming, you know, into that same hall in the other direction, your job was to run into a side room so she couldn't see you.
That's right.
What sort of madness is that? You are a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. I mean, you're a warrior, and everybody else is running into the side room so that she can't see you.
That's right. That was one of her edicts very early on in my time there, was that she didn't want to see the staff in the hallways of the White House, and she didn't want to have to make eye contact with the staff. And it was embarrassing to me, I thought, to see adult White House staff members having to dive into doorways and to escape her gaze and her glance, and she did not want to have to correspond or relate to or deal with White House staff members, no matter how senior. No matter if they were military or political appointees, and it was a very clear and very pronounced edict that you didn't be caught in the hallway by Hillary, and it was very obvious.
I mean, to talk about childish, this makes childishness really pale into insignificance. I mean, here's the First Lady of the land, and she is ordered that nobody is to be walking the opposite direction in the hallway when she is there, as if she is superior to everybody.
Right. Well, it was an imperial presidency, Dr. Stan. It was all about them from my first day there until I left, and it was very clear that they were consumed with power, consumed with ego. It was all about serving them and not being part of them. A very clear line drawn between their inner circle and everybody else, even the military aides. And no doubt in my mind that they felt like they were a monarchy, and we were there to serve them.
And, of course, one of the things that just infuriated me, if you don't mind my saying so, was, you know, you were expected to carry the bags, not only for Hillary and Billary, but, you know, for the other people, like a bell captain in a hotel.
That's right, and I didn't mind doing it for President Clinton or for Mrs. Clinton, really. I assume that was quite part of my job description, but I had a problem with it when it came to the family, the friends, the invited guests, and it really got bad, Dr. Stan, when it came to playing golf and having to haul golf clubs onto golf carts and to bring guest sandwiches and drinks. And I mean, they had their own valets and butlers and personal aides, and I felt it was a little bit demeaning to be an Air Force colonel, pilot, and have to worry about getting sandwiches and drinks for Roger Clinton.
For Roger, I mean, that would be the ultimate. Roger, of course, was Hillary's brother, and Roger Clinton, no, that was the president's brother, wasn't it?
That's right.
Yeah, always in trouble with the law for one thing or another. So, I could see your frustration, being asked to do that. And, but what can you do? You're there. You're to serve our president. But, of course, a man of integrity would never try to demean the people who are there to protect the country, not to serve him.
But, you know, and I didn't mind doing that. And I tell you what really bothered me, Dr. Stan, was the fact that there was never a thank you or a gracious note. It was always expected, kind of quietly expected. With no gratitude, no understanding or consideration to follow, and that definitely bothered me.
Well, we're going to have to take a break here. When we get back, of course, we'll welcome your calls from out across America or in the central, in the great state of Washington, where they're listening to us tonight on five major stations there, Yakima and Spokane and Tri-Cities, Wenatchee. Give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you want to know what it was like living in the White House and working in the White House during the Clinton years, this is your time. Again, the number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Arthur Stan back here, and our guest this evening is Lieutenant Colonel Buzz Patterson, and of course he was the Air Force officer who carried the nuclear football. This was the means by which the president could order a retaliatory strike or a strike on an enemy if America was under attack. Only, of course, he couldn't do that because he lost the codes. And I want to laugh. I don't know whether to laugh or cry at that. And you certainly, what was the response of the four military officers who were there with you, the other three military officers, when they found out the president had lost the codes and he didn't even know when he'd lost the codes?
Well, we were incredulous. Obviously, we were surprised, alarmed, shocked, and what bothers the most, I think, was the fact that he couldn't recall how long they'd been misplaced, and so, therefore, we didn't have any idea how long we had our codes compromised. It could have been days, weeks, or possibly months, and we had to call the Pentagon, obviously, very quickly and get some new codes issued and respond to that, and the president, during the entire time, was more concerned about it not getting into the press than he was about the potential ramifications to national security. So it really bothered us that he didn't have the focus again on his responsibilities.
And of course, everything really is perception. In other words, we wouldn't want the public to know this. We wouldn't want members of Congress to know that. Certainly we wouldn't want anything that would reflect not on the safety of our country, but on Bill Clinton. He obviously was very egotistical then, wasn't he, as far as self-centered and selfish?
Well, absolutely. I tried to analyze him for my 2 years there. I would say he was a very egocentric guy, very, very driven, but also at the same time, interestingly enough, I think he was also very insecure, and I think that explains a lot of his problems with females. I think he was a very powerful, ego-driven man, but at the same time, very, very uncomfortable with himself and with his personal self-confidence, and I think that created a lot of his problems.
I'm sure it did, but of course you can't let this get in the way when you're the President of the United States, and whether you like President Bush or not, at least he gives you the feeling that he is there to and concerned about the safety of our country. And certainly I notice a complete shift in the attitude of the military. I noticed when Bill Clinton was the president, the military very often would, if they did salute him, they were looking the opposite direction. And of course I have a feeling that the attitude of the military towards President Bush is entirely different.
Absolutely, and I can tell you from personal first-hand accounts, a lot of my friends are still active in the military, flying for the Air Force and involved in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they feel a whole new vigor, a whole new motivation to serve. They feel like their commander-in-chief has the moral authority, most importantly, to lead them into harm's way, and that was lacking in the 1990s, and they see the difference very, very clearly.
All right, fine. Well, now, of course, did you get out of the military after you left the White House?
Actually, Dr. Chen, I took one more assignment. I went to the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs and was a cadet commander there for 3 years and retired at that point. Turned down colonel at that point because of my disillusionment with the White House and my time in Washington, D.C., and retired at that point to go into commercial airlines. But it paid a large role in my deciding to get out of the Air Force, and I did that about 2001.
Well, of course, our country's loss was having a get out, but I can understand that, and I think that there are a lot of people who had personal contact with Bill Clinton who just felt so disillusioned. In fact, this afternoon I did an interview with Gary Aldrich. I don't know if you know Gary, but
absolutely,
and he's a personal friend, and he got out of the FBI in, I think, 19, about the time you were getting there. Shortly thereafter, simply because of his disillusionment with the way that things were running in the White House. Now, what about some of the other people in the White House? Were there any that impressed you one way or the other that you came in contact with?
Well, I have to tell you that my fellow military aides, obviously, and the Secret Service members that I worked with were just exceptional. And I felt a great deal of pride and satisfaction with serving with them and a kindred brotherhood with those guys and girls. But on the political side of the staff, there were really few. I did enjoy my association with Erskine Bowles, who was the White House chief of staff for a couple of years while I was there. But for the most part, the rest of the political staff was very loyal to President Clinton, very blindly loyal to President Clinton. I think did not see the foibles and the problems that he had, and were hard to deal with on a regular basis.
Well, were you there during the Monica Lewinsky scandal, or had you left by then?
No, sir. Actually, I was there right in the middle of it. I happened to be, ironically, the first person on President Clinton's schedule the morning that broke in the national media, so I saw his reaction.
Well, what was his reaction, Curtis? This could have brought down his presidency.
I can tell you from walking into the office that first morning, I think it was January 21st, 1998, and seeing his expression and seeing the Washington Post headlines, that he was shell-shocked, he was tired, he was beaten, he was drawn, he was flushed, he was very upset. From that point on, the entire air in the White House, the atmosphere changed dramatically. It became a very dark place to work, and I was there for another 6 months past that. And that was kind of the catalyst, I think, to people seeing into the man and his problems. And for sure, for me, that was the final straw. But for a lot of people there, that was their first inkling that the man had a lot of chinks in the armor.
Well, you know, my understanding is that was when Hillary came forward, and she really took control of things, and whereas Bill tended to withdraw, she was going to be in charge, she was going to go on the attack, she was going to accuse the vast right-wing conspiracy of making up this whole story, and of course, Bill, is this when you begin to see Bill backing away and Hillary in charge?
Absolutely, and that's exactly what happened, actually, and she took over. She ran the show. She ran the crisis management meeting. She did all the spin control. She organized the White House responses and postures and what to say to the press. And she knew very early on, Dr. Stan, that this was true. And I've got her book now. I've been reading it. And for her to say that she didn't understand this was going on or this is true until August of that year was completely false. She knew very, very early on. She was in charge of the whole damage control situation. She knew what was going on from the very, very beginning, and she was in charge.
Well, Chris, you know, I really think that book, and I'm speaking now of Hillary, the new book that just came out, that book should be placed in the fiction part of the bookstore, certainly not in the biography, because there's so much there that this whole thing is part of creating the perception of the aggrieved wife who is willing to stand by her man even though he's lied to her, you know, and yet, of course, their whole marriage was one affair after another, and I've heard from people who are very, very close to the whole situation that she certainly was involved in many of the same sort of things as Bill was, but now with the presidency in danger, why she was going to take charge, and then she set out to demonize and attack everybody that she felt was had anything to do with this, and certainly Newsmax and WorldNet Daily and Rush Limbaugh, and they were all part of a vast right-wing conspiracy that had forced her husband into the arms of Monica Lewinsky. And, of course, they came out really very, very well. I think it's amazing, that Kenneth Starr, he may be a very honorable man, but he did not really go after really the important issues. He simply put himself into a situation where the liberal press could say, well, this is really all about sex. It wasn't about sex at all.
No.
It was about lots of other things. It was about obstruction of justice. It was about perjury. It was about trying to get other people to perjure themselves. And, of course, that was never brought out in the media. Now, did you know Leon Panetta when you were there?
Yes, sir, I did. He was the chief of staff when I first got there, and left about a year into my time, actually.
Okay, fine, because I ran against Leon Panetta for Congress back in 1988. I'm sure glad I lost. I would hate to have had to go back to Washington, D.C., but I don't think there was much chance of beating him. He was he had a very, very powerful force behind Leon that is still there, and, of course, promoting him. He may even become either a presidential or a vice presidential contender one of these days. Well, now, what are some of the other important things that you wrote about that you in your book that you think that our audience should know about?
Well, I think, Dr. Stan, more than anything else, it's the failure on the part of President Clinton, not so much, in the sex aspects or the lying under oath aspects, but in the fact that he was a really poor, and that's a compliment, commander-in-chief. I think he failed miserably as our commander-in-chief in terms of the military. He destroyed military morale. He threw the military down by one-third to one-half. He deployed the military at the exact same time on over 40 different occasions around the world, around the globe, and I think did more to devastate this country's fighting capability and our defense capability than anybody in our history, probably going all the way back to President Washington. I think he was just a horrible commander-in-chief. I think he walked into the job very naive to requirements in terms of our military and foreign policy, and I think he left 8 years later just as out of shape, and I think he really did a lot of damage that we're paying for today in terms of the war on terrorism and the war in Iraq.
And certainly as far as cutting back on the number of divisions we had, the number of air wings, the number of ships, although there had been some disarmament, unilateral disarmament, before he came to the presidency, he certainly accelerated that and put the release into harm's way.
Well, absolutely. He deployed the military overseas in 40 separate occasions, and you compared in the previous 45 years prior to his presidency that the previous presidents in those 45 years deployed us in 8 occasions. So 8 times in the 45 years prior to Clinton and 40 times in his 8 years, and at the exact same time he was drawing down the military by a half. And I think that, more than anything else, just destroyed military morale. And on top of that, he also froze program military pay increases to keep the military in step with civilian population, and I think that also destroyed military morale to the point that it was an all-time low when he left office. And President Bush did a remarkable job, I think, in my mind, in his 2 years, 2.5 years now, rebuilding that morale and motivating the troops and to be the fighting force they are today, to be able to do what they've been doing in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, I always love to tell the story about President Clinton sending American troops to Bosnia and promising the American people that it was only temporary, they'd be home by November. Now, I'm not suggesting that Bill Clinton lied. I'm just saying that he perhaps didn't give you the whole story because he never told you which November he was talking about. Those boys are still over there. Troops are still over there. One of the things that really is demoralizing for our military is to have prolonged times when you're away from your family in peacetime. Isn't that very, very difficult on our military?
Absolutely, and that's one of the reasons why I got out of the military. After 20 years of being gone away from home and having a wife and young kids at home, I wanted to be home too. And the more you're deployed, the more you're overseas, the last person that wants to go to war is a military person. And I think people have a hard time understanding that. But the last person that wants to go to war is somebody in the armed forces. And because that's a break in our family life, in our normal life, in our day-to-day existence. And I think that President Clinton did that so many times in the 1990s that most of us just said, you know what, we're going to quit. We're going to vote with our feet and walk out. And that's what happened under President Clinton.
Well, really, they lost an awful lot of very, very capable people within the Air Force. They lost really a lot of pilots, didn't they, during this time? And really, they've got so much money invested in those pilots. But to have them just saying, we're getting out, especially the seniors who could move on up into the colonel and the ranks of generals, and yet we've lost a significant number of our key military people, haven't we?
Absolutely, and I think it was a big quality cut. I call it a quality cut. I think what happened in the 1990s because of President Clinton and his lack of leadership is that you lost some tremendous talent in the senior military ranks, both officer and enlisted. You had people like General Ron Fogelman, who was the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, quitting prior to his term as the most important Air Force officer, as a four-star, and he left because the disillusionment under President Clinton. And you had people like me who were much more junior in rank, obviously, but we had promising careers, and we also chose to vote with our feet and leave because we didn't want to serve a man who had so little respect and understanding of the military. And I think that we anticipated a President Gore. and thank the Lord we don't have President Gore. And I think that most of us saw that coming and left. And fortunately for us, very thankfully, we have President George Bush, and he's reinstilled a lot of things that we need in this country in terms of a strong commander-in-chief.
All right, fine. Well, our telephone number is 464-8295, or if you're out across America listening to us this evening, it's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1 888-24-LIBERTY, and give us a call if you have a question. We'd love to hear from you. We've only got a few more minutes with Colonel Buzz Patterson, Lieutenant Colonel Buzz Patterson, who's now, are you in the reserve, or are you completely retired?
I'm retired, Dr. Stan, and doing some consulting for the Air Force, and also doing some writing still, and I'm a furloughed airline pilot from Delta Airlines, so I've got several things going.
Well, I hope you'll get back on there. I was just listening to a gentleman today that really been very accurate in his appraisal of things in the past, and he claims that the market's going to be up over 10,000 by October, and of course I don't believe him, and yet of course every other thing he said has been quite accurate. He's been a lot more accurate than I've been, so if that happens, maybe you'll be called back by Delta.
I hope so. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm sure you miss flying, don't you?
Absolutely.
And I think anybody who's ever flown, you just can't understand the thrill that that happens with a takeoff and landing. And, well, of course, are you writing a new book? Or are we going to have another book to interview you on before
long? Yes, sir. Actually, I'm working on one. I'm still in negotiations, actually, with Regnan Publishing again. I'd like to do a sequel to what I'm doing right now and have it the post-Clinton years and how President George W. Bush reinstilled motivation and moral authority and morale into the military, and how that we were able to respond to Iraq and Afghanistan in spite of the drawdowns of the Clinton years, and that's my next goal.
Well, of course, Regnery does a tremendous job on publishing conservative books, and you know they will get out. I think they guarantee a quarter of a million first printing. Well, let's go to Larry, and Larry's calling us from. Larry, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from a cell phone on the way to Seattle from Spokane.
Okay, fine. It's good to have you with us. You have a question or comment?
Well, I just want to say thank you to the Colonel for the service he provided in spite of the tough time he had. I served the military for 23 and a half years, and I'm a retired chief from the Navy. And it's hard for people to realize what we had to go through. We wanted to serve our country, yet we didn't respect the person that was our commander-in-chief.
So. Right. Well, I'm sure that really is really very, very true. And of course, you're listening to us up there in the great state of Washington. What part of Washington are you in? Are you in the central Washington there, coming out of Yakima or where?
Spokane.
Coming out of Spokane. Okay. Do you have a question or comment?
No, I just wanted to thank him for his service. I mean, it's a tough job he had to do, and I realized it from serving myself. And that the other thing I wanted to say was that I don't think the American people realize that when we serve in the military, we give up a lot of rights that they take for granted so that we can serve. We don't have the say, and, you know, we can't get out and petition against, you know, wrongdoings and our political leaders and stuff because we've taken an oath to serve.
I know you do. Well, I God bless you for serving, and I'm glad you're on out of the military now, and maybe you can set up an institute of the Constitution up in that area and help us educate the American people about our Constitution and why we're losing our freedom. Hey, thanks so much for calling, Larry.
Sure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Colonel.
Thank you, Larry.
And I think there are a lot of people out there and across America who are grateful to you for what you've done and for really having the courage to tell this incredible story. And it's so vitally important that people understand that character does count. You know, people always say, oh, it's the economy, stupid, or it doesn't matter what a man does in his bedroom, you know. Well, it does, because if he'll cheat on his wife and he'll cheat on the country, when the chips are down, will he really do what he should? And I think that the great problem we have and we're seeing today is a lack of moral character and integrity on the part of the president. Well, we've got Frieda calling from Pacific Grove. Hi, Frieda. How are you doing?
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for your alternative view on the world politics. I unfortunately disagree with your guest, although I feel that he does have the right to say what he would like to say.
That's fine. Well,
brat, as they call them, or a military dependent, my father served in the Air Force for 20 years, and the motto of the Air Force is peace is our profession. So I heard the gentleman say that he would prefer to stay home with his family. Well, wasn't he happy then with Clinton as a president, because at least he wasn't deployed to two major wars, as in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Actually, Frieda, it was the exact opposite. I was deployed under President Clinton into Somalia, Rwanda, Bosnia, and Haiti.
And I understand those were diplomatic failures as well.
They were, but they were also military engagements.
Yes, but those were not considered illegal wars worthy by the UN.
Frieda, are you a Clinton supporter?
No, I wasn't. I'm not a supporter of him either.
Okay, fine. Well, what was the point you wanted to make?
The point I like to make is I appreciate his viewpoint, but just because Clinton was a conscientious objector would not make him necessarily a bad commander-in-chief. I don't see that Bush is a good commander-in-chief at all.
Well, now, Frieda, did you hear the entire program?
Unfortunately, I didn't.
Well, I hope you will. Maybe you'll get the book and read it. You'll find out that, of course, on a number of occasions, Bill Clinton failed. In fact, one of the things was his major responsibility, his primary responsibility as commander-in-chief, was to be able to respond in case America was attacked. Would you agree that he has the responsibility for defending the country and he has his finger on the nuclear trigger?
Yes, I agree, and so does George Bush, but...
I wish you'd heard the program, because President Clinton lost the keys, lost the codes, and he may have lost them for a year, and nobody
even
knows he lost them.
Yeah, but you're basing, you're judging them in a moral way, too.
Please let me finish. He'd lost the keys, he'd lost the codes, so that if we had been attacked, he couldn't have responded. Now, how would you feel about a man who had lost the codes and was more concerned that the press would find out he'd lost the codes than the fact that the country was in jeopardy?
I feel that if Clinton had been in power when this had happened, at least we would know why it happened, because unfortunately our president now, who was an elected president, doesn't believe that the public has a right to know why 911 happened.
Frieda, you're changing the subject, aren't you?
Well, you're talking about
I'm talking about what we were talking about, and you want to take it over to George Bush. We were talking about what happened when Lieutenant Colonel Buzz Patterson was in the White House, and the fact that he was very disillusioned with the president, not only because he lost the codes, but because he refused to make the hard decisions that are required of a president. I hope next time you listen to the whole program.
I have listened to your program in the past, and I have certainly enjoyed listening to it, because it is an alternative view, and even though we may be on different political sides, many of the views that you have, I agree with.
Well, I would agree with
interest in it all. I've been interested in foreign affairs all my life. I've traveled around the world. I voted in every election. And you know what I support most that you support?
Okay.
The Constitution and our Bill of Rights, which
Amen
has been
that.
Eroded under the president who is now in power.
Well, Frieda, would you get the book and read that, and then maybe you could call one of these evenings and we could talk about what's going on today, because I'm very concerned, as you are.
I believe in being a well-informed citizen.
Okay, God bless you. Thanks,
Frieda.
Thank you
so much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Frieda.
Okay. And, of course, I love talk radio, because Frieda is a very nice person. I've never talked to her before, but she feels so deeply. At least she is willing to be involved and to express her opinions. I just wish we had more people who are willing to take a strong stand, whether I agree with them or not. In fact, I'll have to admit sometimes I have more respect for the dedicated liberal I disagree with than the soft-hearted conservative who would never want to say anything because he's afraid he might offend somebody.
I get that, too.
I know. Well, now, of course, the book is available. It's available at, on Amazon.com. What's the best way to get a copy of your book, Dereliction of Duty?
Well, Dr. it's everywhere now. Hopefully, I think the best bet probably is Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, and it's doing very, very well. It's been on the bestseller list now for 13 weeks in a row, so we're very, very pleased.
Well, I'm so glad it is. And for Frieda, I hope maybe you'll want to call and get a copy of the entire the program tonight, which I think has been an excellent program. I always enjoy having Colonel Patterson on. I'm looking forward then to his next book coming, so that we can have another session with you. But thank you so very much for taking the time to be with us this evening.
My pleasure, Dr. Tan. God bless you.
And you too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, fine. Well, that was Lieutenant Colonel Buzz Patterson, and certainly a patriot, a man who was willing to fight for his country. But, you know, after being away for long periods of time and then totally disillusioned with the presidency and fearing that we would have Al Gore as the next president, he chose to resign his commission and go into private life, even though he probably would have eventually ended up a general or maybe even at a higher level. Who knows what his potential was. He certainly is articulate. And as far as our caller who wanted to talk about George Bush, certainly we can talk about George Bush, and many of you know that I have very, very serious concerns about many of the things that are happening, but at least the perception within the military is one of the reinstitution of pride in what they're doing. But then so much of what's going on today has to do with perception, and of course it's sound bites and what we see on television. There's a great deal of symbolism over substance, rhetoric over reality. Well, be that as it may, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we hope that many of you out there are as concerned about what's happening as I am, and will want to join in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure. So if you are concerned about what's happening, if you're concerned about the progressive erosion of our freedom in the name of fighting terrorism, and I believe that there is a terrorist threat, and I wish we'd just quit protecting the Saudi Arabians or financing the whole Al-Qaeda terrorist movement, because you have to understand that you can't have a worldwide terrorist movement without governments behind them. How are the people going to get the money? How are they going to get the coordination? How are they going to get the training for terrorist acts? Where are they going to get the explosives? And every major terrorist organization has a country behind them. And whether that country would be Iran or Saudi Arabia, and of course, the two of them have been working together for many years. And if you doubt that, you need to get a copy of Joseph Bedansky's excellent book, Bin Laden, the Man Who Declared War Against America, and, of course, his later book, The High Cost of Peace. And both of these books will give you the background, of course, the part that Saudi Arabia has been playing in this. We have another great book. It's called Hatred's Kingdom. It's the story of Saudi Arabia. If you haven't read it, you need to, because it goes into the fact that they've been financing the whole Al-Qaeda movement. It's written by Dora Gould, the ambassador to the United Nations. You need to get the facts, and you need to understand what's going on. And then you need to help us get the word out across America. Why is it that the Saudi Arabian princes who have financed Al-Qaeda both before and after the September 11th attack, and remember 50 of the terrorists came from Saudi Arabia, as did Osama bin Laden, and Osama bin Laden's family is very, very close to George Herbert Walker Bush, former director of the CIA, member of Skull and Bones, member of the board of directors of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a front for a secret society that began in England in 1891, a member of the Trilateral Commission, attended Bilderberger meetings, and of course a member of the Skull and Bones secret pagan society. And of course, so the bin Laden family is very close to George Herbert Walker Bush, who's advising the president at the present time on foreign policy. And I'm really very, very concerned that the reason we're not doing anything about the Saudi financing of the terrorists is because of the father's connection to the bin Laden family. So I think that you need to get all the facts. You can get a lot of information at our website at RadioLiberty.com and pull down the articles in September and October and November and December of 2001, and go through a couple of the other articles we have on really what happened on 9/11, and then decide that you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And of course, when you join, you get the four best tapes of the month, you get the monthly newsletter, and we'll keep you appraised of what's really going on behind the scenes. Please tell others to listen to our programs. Encourage them to go to our website at RadioLiberty.com and listen to our archive programs. Listen to the live programs. This program will be archived for a month. And then help us to reach others with an understanding that freedom is under attack today, and not from the sources that most people think. So, of course, until tomorrow at the same time, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, because if America doesn't turn back to God, why, God will certainly never again bless this nation. And we ask you to pray for our ministers, because they should be leading this truly spiritual battle. And lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow evening at the same time, when we'll be back once again, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we ask you to hold your calls for the time being because, well, we're hoping to have with us on the line Randy Thomason for a campaign for California families to keep us abreast of what's going on up in Sacramento. If we can't get him, we'll get Brad Dacus on. And, of course, we'll talk to him about what's happening on the legal front across California. But you have to understand that there is a conspiracy against God. There's a conspiracy against Christianity, and people say, oh, well, how can you say something like that? Conspiracy? Only crazy people think of conspiracy. Well, certainly if you believe in the Bible at all, and you read the Bible, you'll find that the word conspiracy and reference to the conspiracy against God is often mentioned. Jeremiah 11:9, Ezekiel 22:25, the second Psalm. There's always been a conspiracy against God, and that's really what this is all about today. Now, we were talking in the last hour about the White House under the Clinton administration. There were witches' covens meetings there, I'm told, from people I know and I respect their opinion. There were witches' covens meetings in the White House when Hillary was there. And, of course, you remember, she had actually gotten Jean Houston to come to the White House to conjure up the spirits of Eleanor Roosevelt and Mohandas Gandhi. Last evening, you remember, we had a guest, a gentleman who'd written a book on Robert Mueller. Of course, Robert Mueller sounded really very good from the book, but if you saw who'd endorsed the book, why, it was Jean Houston and Barbara Marx-Huppert, who talks of the necessity of killing a quarter of the population, and in the original context of her book, which we have, and we'll be glad to send anybody the pages from it who'd like it. It was called The Revelation, the Book of Co-Creation. Actually came out in hardback, financed by the Lawrence Rockefeller Endowment for the Humanities. But in the first volume of her book, in other words, before it was cleaned up for public distribution, she talked about the necessity of killing a quarter of the world's population, those people who would not evolve to a higher state of consciousness, like if she and her followers had. But then she said, that's not your job, my dear. That is ours, for we are the riders of the pale horse death. She also, Barbara Marx-Huppert, also endorsed a book last night by Robert Mueller, as did Ted Turner. And, of course, you begin to see this strong anti-Christian, truly demonic influence within the ranks of the people there, and certainly Jean Houston is deeply involved with the occult. And yet she was called to the White House by the First Lady to conjure up spirits. Does that bother you at all? If you think that's funny, why, you may very well die laughing. It's sort of like the scam that they pulled this last weekend. We're on the evening of midnight on June 21st. They released the volume 5, the fifth in the Harry Potter series of books. Why is it release a book at midnight on June 21st? Why, very simply, because that is the high holy day of the witches and the Satanists and the Druids. In fact, there were over 30,000 pagans and Druids at Stonehenge on the following day. They all understand what it's about. They will tell you that Harry Potter has created a tremendous increase in the occult and in witchcraft and druidism. And you can learn all about it up on the internet, on the web pages. But then how many good Americans are going to go up and look on the pagans' web pages or understand that, of course, we are indoctrinating literally tens of millions of the youth of America and certainly probably 100 million children throughout the world in the pagan witchcraft agenda. And, of course, it all started, a long time ago. In fact, almost all of the books that have been released in this Harry Potter series have been released, or the movies have been released, on high holy days for the occult and the dark side. Well, with that as a background, let's go to our special guest this evening. And, of course, it's Brad Dacus. Hi, Brad. How are you doing?
Oh, doing great, Dr. Stanley.
Tell us what's going on in the legal field. It's probably not as interesting as Harry Potter, but of course it may be much more important as far as the survival of the Christian way of life here in California.
Well, yes, we've got an exciting victory that took place out of Dixon.
Could you speak up just a little louder?
Oh, sure. We had an exciting victory out of Dixon that we're very pleased with. Can you hear me better now?
Yes, much better.
Oh, good. And this is a case where Calvary Chapel there, we've talked about this before, where they're trying to keep them out. And we prevailed, and they got into their building that they bought. Well, then they received a letter from the fire district manager from the city giving them 14 days to move out of the building, or they would be forcefully removed from the building. And we were preparing to file a lawsuit in federal court to stop this outrageous, intolerant act by this an unreasonable act. And at the same time, an attorney we've worked with before, Eric Grant, worked with the city, negotiated a settlement that not only stopped what they were trying to do, but the city, but also gave them a permanent assurance that they would never be removed from that facility.
Now, what was the justification for the fire marshal, the fire department, doing that?
Well, what he decided to do was try to invoke new standards that are being implemented on new buildings that were not implemented on this building at the time it was built, or any of the other buildings and businesses on the same street. So it was a real, just a sheepish way to try to undercut the rights of this church. And after we really called them to the mat on it, not needless to say, they backed down, and we're very glad that they did.
Well, of course, you know, the thing is that there really is an anti-Christian agenda out there. There is an anti-Christian conspiracy, and these people go to any end and do accomplish their goals to thwart, you know, the purpose of the people of God trying to establish churches or home churches or Christian schools or, you know, and so it's so important that we have you out there, Brad, to represent these people, because if they have to go out and get a lawyer, first of all, the lawyer probably wouldn't know what it was all about unless he was trained in this field of law. And secondly, of course, they will simply harass people and force them into going along, you know, for fear of bankruptcy or having to put out hundreds of thousands of dollars for legal fees and then maybe losing the case. So what you do serves such an important purpose here in California. I'm sure you're probably universally hated by the people on the dark side.
I think that's probably the case. And anyway, we'll have to see how more of these cases plan out. Also, one other little side note, which is some more good news, is the fact that the Supreme Court did uphold the internet filtering against pornography in public libraries. It was a law passed by Congress. The Supreme Court upheld it as constitutional, and I'm proud to say that because of the work of one of our affiliate attorneys at one of our cases, Michael Millen, a number of years ago, this probably would never even become a law. It was that lawsuit that we filed to try to stop this in a library in San Jose, where they let little children look at hardcore pornography on the internet. It was because of that lawsuit that we understand that this bill came about in the first place.
Well, because really these wicked and evil people actually want to corrupt the minds of our youth. That's what it's really all about. All this has nothing to do with freedom of speech or freedom of press or anything of this sort. These people have an agenda, and it's to corrupt the minds of the youth. Now, what are they going to do then in the libraries? Are they going to have a situation there where people are going to have to get permission to unblock it so they adults can watch the pornography, sick adults can watch it?
That's correct. And let me make something really clear, Dr. Stanley. If there's a library out there that doesn't comply with this requirement for federal funding, we will move on it very swiftly and aggressively.
Well, now, of course, one of the things that our local library here in the city of Santa Cruz is saying, well, we're just going to forego the federal funding. So then what do? Have they managed to thwart us? Of course, then they'll say, we got to raise the taxes because we don't have that money. So, you know, if you believe in books and you don't want us to close the library down 6 days a week, well, you're going to have to give us more money. because we lost the federal funding. So what else can we, what do we do if they just say, we're not going to take the federal funding?
Well, if they don't take the federal funding, and of course we don't have any similar legislation coming from this governor or legislature, unfortunately, then parents basically just simply have to keep their kids out of the public libraries. And of course, we still have other issues dealing with dirty magazines that are still made available to young children and other things like that that still have yet to even be addressed on the federal level.
Well, you know, really, as you get into really an understanding of this, what they were trying to do is promote, you know, sexual activity in our children. They want to do away with all moral bounds and all moral restrictions on everybody. They want ultimate freedom to do whatever feels good, just like Aleister Crowley, who, of course, was a Satanist, said, do what thou wilt. That's the whole of the law. There are no restrictions. Well,
right.
That is not freedom. Freedom is not the ability to do what you want to do. It's what you should do, because if there are no restrictions on what you do, we have moral anarchy, and that's the direction we're headed. That's what these people want. Well, look, I know you can't comment one way or the other on the effort to recall Governor Davis, but how are they doing as far as collecting signatures, do you know?
I've heard mixed stories on that. I know it's impressive. I've heard everything from 400,000 to 700,000. And some people say it's just a matter of whether it's going to be this November or next March where we'll have the recall election. But we'll have to wait and see. And of course, who knows who's going to be running if he is recalled. But one good thing about California is we are a state where we have the freedom and ability to recall our governors.
Well, you know, one of the most interesting things is a church on Sunday, a gentleman who had never really expressed any interest at all in politics stopped me and commented on the recall of Governor Davis. And then he mentioned the possibility, well, maybe we can get, Tom McClintock in there and really get something going. And I thought, this man obviously has a real understanding of what's going on, and of course, just because he'd never spoken to me on the issues before, I suddenly realized he was very well informed. He knows who Tom McClintock is, and incidentally, he's a gentleman who ran for a comptroller. He's a God-fearing, a conservative, who's really would to make a great comptroller, or certainly a great governor. But I was surprised to hear that the average individual out there is hearing, and this is very encouraging to me.
Yeah, I know Tom, and he's a fine man, and we definitely need more public servants like him, that's for sure.
Okay, fine. Anything else you'd like to tell us, or do you want to get out your telephone number and, of course, your website?
Oh, you bet. Our telephone number is 888-305-9129. That's 888-305-9129. And our website is pacificjustice.org. That's pacificjustice.org.
All right, fine. Well, thank you for everything you do, Brad. And incidentally, if you're out there in the listening audience and you'd like, of course, to get Brad to come to your church for a talk or anybody else to come for a talk, why, of course, get in touch with him. He's a great speaker, and we'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
Thank you.
Good night.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Brad Dacus. And, of course, I guess we're not going to have Randy on this evening. He works awfully hard, and something may well have come up. So we're probably going next to our special guest this evening, Tony Webb. And Tony is a missionary in Thailand, of all places. He called. Apparently, he had run into one of the people we know, a man named Kevin Gorman, who has been working over in Thailand and Southeast Asia for many years, trying to track down the men that were abandoned in Vietnam. And, of course, this was not only in Vietnam, but in Laos. None of the people in Laos ever came home. And many of them, of course, were pilots who were shot down over there, or government employees who were working there. And, of course, they were seized by the communists. They've been held for ransom. And we refused to ransom them. We could have gotten all of our men back when the Vietnamese were anxious to give them back in return for recognition so they could get loans from America. But our leaders didn't want them to come back because they didn't want the American people to know that they've been lying to us for years. Well, Tony apparently somehow or other ran into Kevin Gorman on the streets over. But I'm going to let Tony tell the story. Tony, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me.
Why don't you tell us how you happened to run in? Is it Kevin Gorman?
Yes, sir. I don't think you want us to mention his name, but...
Oh, that's all right.
Something like that.
Okay, go ahead. Anyway, you ran into Kevin. We won't give his last name.
Right. I was born in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. My dad is a Special Forces, retired Army, U.S. Army. And his job is actually to search for the POWs. He's even doing that today.
Is he really?
With the JTFFA.
What is the JTFFA?
Well, that's a joint task force. That means all branches of the military, Army, Air Force, Marines, Navy. And they send teams in the jungle, and what they're trying to recover is remains of dead soldiers.
I don't want the dead ones. I want to get the live ones.
Right,
that we
but
know
this,
there,
this,
that
this is what the U.S. government, this is what the U.S. government's doing, so they can put this issue and say, see, they're all dead, and we've accounted for them all. And they have only a certain number that they say that need to be accounted for. And that's what my dad does, and that's how I ended up over in Thailand.
Okay, and when did you go over to Thailand?
When I was 16 years old. I'm 29 years old now. So that was...
13 years ago.
13 years ago, right.
All right, and Fai, so what is Thailand like today? You know, of course, we always sort of imagine Anna and the King of Siam. Is that is that the world of Thailand today? What's going on over there?
No, that movie is a complete farce and a lie, and it is such a lie that the Thai government has banned that movie from even coming into the country.
You mean you can't see Yul Brynner there?
No, because the king, back in those days, you couldn't even look upon the king. They consider him what they call an Indian. They take the Indian language. They call it Deha Raja.
Like a god.
Right, a god in the flesh.
Well, it was a good movie, and it doesn't matter whether it's true or not, you know. Well, anyway, so tell us, what is Thailand like today, and why are you going back over
again? What happened was, since I was raised in Thailand, so 16, I didn't go there as a Christian. And by the time I was 21 years old, I was... Thai boxing, which is the kickboxing with the knees and elbows too. In Thai, they call it Muay Thai, which is Thai kickboxing. I was doing that for a living, but I started searching for God. I ran into a Christian and gave me a track. I got born again in Thailand 8 years ago. And ever since then, I've just been out evangelizing. And God called me to do the work of an evangelist, to preach the gospel.
All right, well, is there much opportunity for that in Thailand? Is there any restriction on of course, Christian missionaries there?
They don't have much laws yet. They're really big in the freedom of religion, what they call it. Now, Thailand is 94% Buddhist, about 5% Islam, and Christianity is about 0.05% in Thailand. The Protestant Christians, the Presbyterians are the first Protestants to go over there. They've been there for 150 years, and it's still 0.05% Christians.
All right, well, what sort of results are you having in your effort to evangelize?
For myself, because all God called me to do is to preach the gospel. And, of course, you know, from the scriptures, the preaching the gospel, the preaching of the cross is the power of God. The gospel of Christ is the power of God into salvation. So anytime anybody goes out and preaches the word of God, just the gospel alone, there's going to be a lot of results in Thailand, or anywhere you go, preaching the gospel.
Oh, now, how do you get an opportunity to do that? You do it on street corners?
I do it everywhere, every place, to everybody. You know, it says in the Bible, God hath ordained they that preach the gospel should live with the gospel. It's my life. It's not, you know, I everywhere I go, I'm preaching the gospel. And that's why I met our friend. He didn't want to mention his name. I was out preaching the gospel in the streets. Being that I'm an American, my mother's Vietnamese, but I was born in America. And then I was born again in Thailand, an American born again in Thailand. So I also have a heart to reach the international people coming to Thailand. And you get people from all over the world because of the Buddhist influence there. It's a completely Buddhist country, but with freedom of religion. Some other Buddhist countries... You can't go over there and do their Buddhism because it's a Buddhist country with no freedom of religion. But because Thailand has freedom of religion, a man who's not a Buddhist can go there and learn of Buddhism, practice Buddhism, and then pick and choose what he wants out of it and actually become a Buddhist. So it's really a big place for the New Agers who want to put all the religions together and pick and choose what they want of all the different religions. So there's a lot of international people visiting Thailand from around the world.
Well, do they have any industry? How is it?
Tourism is the main industry.
Really?
I mean, after that's agriculture, but tourism is the main industry.
I mean, we see these pictures, these beautiful temples and buildings,
right.
And that's sort of my vision of Thailand.
That's what draws the tourists. And see, the thing is, you don't have to convert to Buddhism to go in those temples and to learn of Buddhism. You can actually go in and become a monk and not even be a Buddhist. In other Buddhist countries, you'd have to become a Buddhist to do that. They wouldn't allow you to do that. But see, Thailand, with this freedom of religion, they want everybody to come and experience Buddhism and then pick and choose what you want. And that's what the Thais have done with Buddhism. Before Buddhism came to Thailand, they were animists. They worshiped the spirits. And so they just added Buddhism into their spirit worship. So you'll see a Buddha shrine and Buddha temples just about every street corner. And then everywhere you see these little bitty houses on stilts almost. Little bitty houses with food. They change the food every day and incense. And what they're for is for spirits, devils, because that's what they worship there.
I see. Well, is that part of normal Buddhism?
That's a Thai animist.
Okay, then. So they sort of marry then animism and Buddhism and come up with their own brand of religion.
Right. And that's basically what everybody did, every country did Buddhism. Because Buddhism is really just a philosophy. It was just a bunch of teachings. And so every country goes, it can adapt to those countries.
Well, of course, Buddha was a Hindu who sort of came up with his own branch of Hinduism. And
right.
Of course, the whole idea, isn't it sort of to get to the point where you're nothing? And once you're nothing, then you've got to where you want to be?
Right. It has that circular reasoning like that. When you become nothing, you become everything, that weird kind of stuff. But the most important thing about Buddhism in these last days that Satan really wants to use, and that's why it's being promoted, is that Buddha did give a prophecy of a coming savior.
Well, tell us about that, because I'm not acquainted with that.
He said that a man would come, and in the Bali, P-A-L-I, that's the language that a lot of his writings were in, either in Bali or Sanskrit, being that Southeast Asia's Theravada sect Buddhism, they go for the Bali writings. And then the other sect of Buddhism is called Mahayana sect, and they read the Sanskrit writings. Well, in the Bali writings, Buddha's prophesied of a coming savior. He named his name, it would be pronounced sort of like Mithya. And he said this man would unite the world, he would be the final Buddha, and would unite the world into unity, and also put everybody on a one-world money system.
Well, of course, that sounds like the Antichrist.
It's exactly the Antichrist, and that's why I believe that Buddhism is getting such a big revival nowadays, and everybody's going for the Buddhism.
Yes.
You know, here in Hawaii, where I've been for the past month preaching the gospel in the streets, I meet all these Americans who have turned to Buddhism, wearing Buddhas on their neck, and they hardly know anything about the religion at all. But I believe that's why Satan has his hand on this religion, these teachings, because of what he gave. And so when the Antichrist shows up, and the world is really big in respecting this religion of passiveness, Buddhism, who promotes all this peace, and then it's talking about this coming world savior.
Well, of course, the trouble is that once all the power is given to this world government, that power can be used to kill anybody who doesn't want to go along with it.
Right.
In the name of peace, of course.
Right, in the name of peace, of course. Right.
How do you manage to survive over there? Do you have a job at all, or what do you do?
Well, when the Lord called me to preach, you know, the scripture says, God hath ordained they that preach the gospel should live the gospel. So all I do, I just focus on the preaching of the word and spend a lot of time in prayer and study the word and preaching the word. And the Lord has promised to supply all my need, and he does in different ways. And of course, to the God's people, but different people. I never give any kind of, ask for any kind of donations. I've been preaching here in Hawaii. This past month, I've been able to preach at 6 different churches, and I never once asked for any money.
But, of course, God provides for you, is that
and
it?
God provides for me through his people, of course.
Now, of course, how...
He didn't rain money down from heaven. He, you know, he uses his people, but I let God touch people's hearts, speak to people, and then they'll give to me their own free will.
Okay, fine. And, of course, you're going to be there in Hawaii for how long?
I'm leaving this Friday back to Thailand.
And then you're going back to Thailand? Well,
yes, sir.
Do you have an address or a website in case people want to get in touch with you?
Okay, I have an email.
Okay, what is it?
It is S-I-T-H-P-R...
What is S-I-P-H?
Right, P-R-A-Y-E-S-U at hotmail.com.
Sif prayer...
Pray Isu.
Sif pray Isu at hotmail.com.
Right.
Well,
then my mailing address in Thailand is Brother Tony, Webb, W-E-B-B, P.O. Box 20. And then the next line would be a word called Sutisan, which is S-U-T-T-H-I-S-A-N, and then Bangkok, B-A-N-G-K-O-K, and the zip code is 10321.
10321.
Yes, sir.
Well, you know, Chris, tourism is big over there. Has the 9/11, the things that are happening, the American economy cut back on tourism at all?
No, tourism is going to always be big there, and it's actually gotten bigger because of 9/11. Not because of the Americans, but because of the Middle Easterners, especially Israelis. See, the Israelis, they don't want to be there in Israel, especially the non-religious Israelis who are New Agers, and they've been coming to Thailand, a lot of them, and they come to stay there, just escape from Israel.
In other words, they actually have homes over there?
Right. There's three Orthodox Jewish synagogues in Bangkok, and one of the synagogues is five stories tall. That's how many Israelis are there.
Well, are these Israelis buying property, or what are they doing?
Israelis, they're always doing business. they can sell anything.
All right. Well, they're good businessmen. They always have been good businessmen. So
right,
actually, then there's an influx of Israelis or secular Jews into Thailand.
Right. Yes, sir. They'll do the religion, too, but when you speak to them on the street, they'll have a Buddha on their neck and... You know, they'll say they believe in the Torah, the law, but they don't practice it. And they're really open for the gospel of Jesus Christ, especially when they see somebody loves them.
Well, I'll tell you what, that when you have a Jewish Christian, they're usually the best Christians you'll find.
I
have some of them as friends and some of them as supporters. And they really do. If you can touch the lives of a Jewish person, first of all, you save his eternal soul. But more than that, of course, he'll become a real champion for the Lord, like
right.
Paul was.
Yes, they do. And just to give an example, I went to the big synagogue one day. And I was sitting there doing their service. And they're doing their prayers. They pray out loud in the Hebrew prayers in the prayer book. I happened to just be sitting there, and the rabbi turned around and saw me. He said, "Hey, what are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, a Jewish man saved my life a few years ago." So I just went on to the Jews. "A Jewish man saved your life? Where?" I was like, "Here in Thailand." So he called all of his congregation over to me. And I got to testify how Jesus the Jew saved my life.
Oh, I'm sure that when they realized it really been put on.
Yeah, so he said to me, the rabbi says, "You know, we ban him at the door here." And so I asked him, I said, "Do you allow me in here?" He says, "Yes." And I said, "Well, if you allow me in here, then Jesus is in here." And I used his Hebrew name, Yeshua. And the rabbi said, "Okay." He said, "I'll cut you a deal." He says, "I understand it'll be virtuous for you to try to convert us." He said, "Let us finish our service for the next 2 hours, and then when we're finished, I will give you a chance to speak." So they went to their service. I got to enjoy it. It's beautiful, beautiful language, and they pray it, Hebrew. And then we went to eat up on the top floor. And in front of all this congregation, he asked me, put me on the spot, and said, "Okay, this is your time.
Hold on. We'll get to that in just a moment
okay.
here.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Tony Webb, and of course he is a Christian missionary in Thailand, and of course he's telling us what happened when he went to the Jewish synagogue there in Bangkok. So pick up this story. They finished their meal. You're on the top floor of this six-story synagogue, and now you're going to have an opportunity to present your position to the Jewish congregation of the synagogue.
So we're in front of the whole congregation at this table, and he put me on the spot. He said, this is your time now. Tell us why you believe Jesus is the Messiah. And so he allowed me to go through all the different prophecies of the Old Testament. And I got to speak for about 30 minutes. And that's a long time to, you know, when you're speaking the Bible, that's a long time. You can say a lot of things in 30 minutes. And what stopped me was he asked me, and everybody was interested. Everybody was silent. Nobody interrupted me. They listened to me go through the prophecies. He asked me, how do you know so much about this? Because I was using nothing but the Old Testament scriptures. And I said to him that in America, there is a lot of Jews that do believe in Jesus. And so I've read up on their works and how to witness to Jewish people and to present the gospel to Jewish people. And the rabbi's wife came out. She had been in the kitchen doing some stuff. And she said, well, they're not Jewish then, and escorted me to the door. When I looked at the rabbi, he gave me that look. You know, I'm married, too. So he gave me that look like, you know, please, I want to be happy. I don't want to have a bad day today with my wife. So I decided to shook everybody's hand and said shalom to them all, and I was able to leave. So that's just an example of how the gospel is, the door is open to reach the Jewish people there in Thailand.
Well, of course, you know, if they really have studied the Old Testament, and, you know, what is it, Isaiah 53?
Right.
Certainly, that is a wonderful, wonderful passage. In fact, I've even talked to Jews who told me that in the various Jewish colleges where they're teaching rabbis, they remove that from the Bible. Because
right, they
how
don't,
else
they don't
can
read
you explain it? And why don't you tell our listeners who may not know the Bible as well as you do, why Isaiah 53 is so important to an understanding as it foreshadows the coming of the Messiah?
Well, as all the Jewish people believe, there's the first five books of Moses called the Law. And that's all the thou shalt and thou shalt not. Everybody's familiar with that. The commandments. And in the first five books of Moses, there's 613 commandments. And God is just and fair. If you kept all those commandments perfect your whole life, well, then you'll be able to go to heaven on your good works. But, of course, we all know, and this is why God gave us that law, we've broken those commandments many times in our lives. But the prophet Isaiah spoke of God, through the mouth of God, that God would send forth a servant, which would be a man. And it starts off in Isaiah 52, verse 13. God saying, behold, my servant shall deal prudently. He shall be exalted and extolled and be very high. And so we see it's going to be a person, a man. It's going to be a servant. And then it goes on to say that this person would be wounded for our transgressions. He would be bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace would be upon him, and with his stripes we'd be healed. And he goes on to say that all we like sheep have gone astray, we have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. And so in that chapter of Isaiah 53, and you read the whole thing, it talks about this servant that God would send, who would die for our sins, and also be raised again from the dead in Isaiah 10, 53, verse 10 onwards, that he'd rise again from the dead. And that right there is the gospel. How Christ died for his sins according to the scriptures and was buried on the third day, rose again from the dead. And when somebody believes that by faith, and then by faith calls upon Jesus who fulfilled the scripture, we can be saved.
Well, I think
and the reason why they would not read it or not look at it, because if you read this chapter, just at first glance, your first reading of it, you'll know exactly who it talks about. So even sometimes when I'm sharing this chapter to Jewish people in Thailand, they'll say to me, I do not believe in the New Testament. Because it's so clearly talking about Jesus.
Well, of course, the thing is that you would approach them with the Old Testament and all of the prophecies of the coming of the Messiah.
Right.
And, of course, did Jesus fulfill these prophecies? That is the thing. And I think if you can convince them that he did, or at least getting to wonder if that is the possibility that he did,
right,
then, of course, you can begin to reach them with an understanding that Jesus is the Messiah, that every Jew waits, everybody who really believes in the Old Testament, they're all waiting for the coming of the Messiah.
Right. And then another scripture that's very powerful, and again, the rabbis have banned this chapter, Daniel chapter 9. It told of the Messiah's first coming and even gave the date. And if you calculate that date in Daniel chapter 9, you come with the exact date that Jesus came.
And Chris, why don't you explain to our listeners, this is actually, was a prophecy that was given from the time then the, I guess it was Cyrus who would order the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem until the time of the Messiah's coming was going to be how long?
Right, it goes in Daniel chapter 9, verse 25, he says, "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall, even in troublous times." Now, when I'm on the streets, people don't have the time to calculate how many years that is. So I read the next scripture, and it says, "And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the Prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be as a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined." So what I'll share with them is that at this time that Daniel's prophesizing, Jerusalem has been destroyed. And he's prophesizing that it would be rebuilt again. And after the commandment given to rebuild Jerusalem, at a certain time the Messiah would come. And that the Messiah would come and be cut off, meaning he would die not for himself but for the people. And then it goes on to say that Jerusalem would be destroyed again.
And it really was destroyed again. Of course,
right, in 70 or 73 A.D., however you calculate it. But it was destroyed again. So you try to find who claimed to be the Messiah, died not for himself but for the people, in between the rebuilding of Jerusalem in Daniel's time and the destruction of Jerusalem in around 70 A.D. There's only one person that fits there.
Well, now, Chris, what sort of response are you getting from the Jewish people you're talking to? Are you getting their interest? Are some of them beginning to understand that this is the fulfillment of their prophecies?
Just about everyone that will listen to me is a gift from the Word of God, and this is how powerful the Word of God is. Not with me. It's just preaching the Word. They will know who it's talking about. Faith comes right there. But the problem is some people, they may not want to believe for fear of their family cutting them off. Some people may fear their religious authority over them. Or some people fear if they believe in this, actually, what would happen at their workplace? What would happen in their life? But just about everyone that speak to and that sits down with me or allows me to go through the scriptures with them, they will know exactly who it's talking about.
Now, of course, are these primarily Jewish people you're talking to or are these other visitors?
Jewish people, and in the past 5 months have been laboring especially with the Muslims from all these Arab countries.
No,
and again, it has to do with September 11th.
Are more Arabs coming into the country than before?
There are so many Arabs in Bangkok itself. They have one area called Middle East Street, and it's all Arabs.
Well, now, why are the Arabs coming into Bangkok?
Again, business.
I see.
First,
okay.
Thailand's open. Freedom of religion, they'll everybody come in. And then there's a lot of business that goes on there. And plus, rumors. You know, my dad's in the military, so I hear a lot of rumors. They get to do a lot of planning in Thailand because it's so lenient and they all can come in there.
Now, you're talking about the planning for terrorist attacks?
Right.
Like
yes.
All right. Well, then, of course, you think that many of the Arabs, or at least some of the Arabs that are coming on, are part of the Al-Qaeda movement.
Or even the other groups, a lot of other groups.
Well, you're not talking about the Muslim Brotherhood or Jihad or Hezbollah or Hamas or some of the others?
Yes. I mean, they come from all the countries that they're in Bangkok.
Well, of course, usually, of course, if you are going to be a terrorist organization, you have to have a source of funding. In other words, you know, you can't spend your full time being a terrorist unless
right.
you get a lot of money behind you. So where's the money coming from for this? Do you have any idea?
Import and export, and that's where they're in Thailand. They can export things and for those countries that they need, such as silk. Thai silk is real cheap. The herbs that they cook with. They get them all there in Southeast Asia, and clothing, other than silk, but other kinds of clothing. They do a lot of import-export, and that money can be used for other things, too.
Okay, and so you think that's where they're getting their funding. Is any of it coming from Saudi Arabia?
There's a lot of Saudi Arabians there.
A lot of Saudi Arabians there. Now,
yes.
Why would Saudi Arabians be, of all places, Bangkok?
again, because the silk is very, very cheap. And these herbs, you know, they cook the food with a certain amount of herbs. Their food, it has a lot of herbs in it. That's where they get that smell from.
You're talking about Saudi Arabia or in Bangkok?
In Thailand.
Okay.
Or Southeast Asia. And Thailand is a gateway to all of Southeast Asia. And so if they're going to do business in a Muslim nation such as Malaysia or Indonesia, Bangkok has all the more technology in those countries that they can use there.
Well, is it expensive to live over there?
It's very cheap to live in Thailand.
I see.
Very cheap.
What sort of a climate does it have?
It's a hot climate. They have
the hot season and then the
hotter season and a rainy season.
I see. So you've lived there for, well, for what, 13 years?
13 years.
Okay.
So I'm here in Hawaii freezing.
Okay, fine. Of course, you're going to be going back over there. How did you happen to leave there and come to Hawaii? Did you have an invitation to come, or did you just sort of feel that the Lord led you to come?
Right, exactly. I preach, and what I do, I'm just an evangelist. God didn't call me to pastor. He didn't call me to do a mission. I'm not really a missionary. I'm an evangelist. I just preach. I go to the lost, and that's where I do my ministry, is winning souls to the Lord. But I also, you know, preach at churches to encourage the brothers and sisters in Christ at the same time. And so as I was preaching, and everything's doing well in Thailand last month, in prayer, I really felt led by the Spirit of God to come to Hawaii for 1 month. And I told my wife about this, and she kind of felt the same leading. Now, there's no voices, there's no lightnings, but just like, you know, still small voice in the inside. So nothing had hurt by praying for that. And then about a week time after we prayed, another missionary that I know of, he's in Thailand teaching English, but using English as a means to win the lost to the Lord. We'll eat lunch together every once in a while. And so we're eating lunch one day. He hands me an envelope full of money and says, "The Lord told me to give this to you." And what do you know, it's enough for a one-way ticket to Hawaii. And so I came here without any prior engagements. I came to Hawaii, started calling up people I know, preaching different places, and doors would just open up from one place to the next. And everybody asked me, "When are you going to go back to Thailand?" And I would say, "By the 30th, not having any money. And not even tell anybody. I don't have any money. I would tell them, "I'm going back on the 30th. But I got to preach at a pastor's breakfast meeting to encourage a bunch of pastors here in Hawaii. And one man who I've just met, when I got home from the breakfast, he had called me. He took my home phone number here in Hawaii. And so the Lord really impressed to give me a little love offering, and he wanted to talk with me, who I was, in more in detail. And so we spent about the whole day together. I have so many testimonies to share and just encouraging this brother. We told this other sister in the Lord that goes to his church about me. She starts praying for me and says the Lord told her to buy me a plane ticket. And then they called me from the travel agency wanting to know what day I'd like to go back. And that's how I got a ticket for the 27th.
I see. So you're going back 3 days early.
I lose a day. I arrived there on the 29th. And so then, you know, they're fresh on the 30th.
All right. Well, I'm so glad that... you know, of course, God does work in very, very strange and mysterious ways.
Yes.
Don't make any sense to people who are not Christians.
As he promised in Jeremiah 33:3, "Call upon me, and I will answer thee, and show thee things thou knowest not."
Well, of course,
that's the power of God. He will do things for us that we can't even imagine.
Well, of course, to live totally by faith takes a great deal. You're lucky to have a wife that will go along with you.
Well, my wife, I praise the Lord for my wife, I'm really blessed, but the reason she'll go along with me is we lived together for 3 years before I was saved, in sin, and I was a boxer, I was drinking, I was gambling, I was smoking drugs, I had to come home at all hours of the night, sometimes not come home for days, but she loved me, but I was such a bad person. So in 1995, 8 years ago, when I told her, "I'm going to become a Christian now. I'm going to believe the Bible." She let a little fleece out and said, "Jesus, if you can change this guy, I'm going to believe on you." And lo and behold, I became a new creature in Christ. She believed on Jesus. She became a new creature in Christ. And so being we both get saved on the same time, we have the consecration, Lord, together.
Well, I think that's wonderful.
Yes.
And of course, it's a challenge, and of course, it takes a lot of faith to do exactly what you're doing. Now, do you have an opportunity to talk at any of the churches over there in Bangkok? How many Protestant churches are there?
being that there is only 0.05% Christians in Thailand, but there's still quite a few churches. Now, a lot of the Protestant churches, sad to say, are not even born again. And so just by going and preaching the basic gospel of Jesus Christ, I actually saw, and this is no lie, a pastor get saved in a meeting in Thailand. The pastor of the church.
Well, I'm sure that there are ministers who are really not born again.
Right.
They don't have a personal relationship with the Lord.
Right.
They have all the book learning, but they don't have the heart change that is really so necessary to be effective.
Right.
So you talk at the churches, but you just meet people on the street, or do you meet people in hotels, or how do you meet people and have the opportunity to witness to them?
As I said, I go into every place I can to everybody I can reach with the gospel. And I will go out of my way, and the person that our common friend, he didn't want me to tell his name.
All right, fine. We'll call him K. Right?
Yeah, we'll call him K.
Right.
I had saw him on the street. I went up to him and asked him if he was born again. Well, he saw me. I'm wearing a necktie. I had a white shirt on. So he thought it has to be a Mormon, because who would be in Bangkok, Thailand, preaching the gospel? So he starts running away from me. He said, yes, he was born again, and started leaving me real fast. But when he said, yes, he was born again, I wanted to catch up with him. So I had to actually chase him down. True story, I chased him down. And then he said, what are you, a Mormon? I said, no, I'm not a Mormon. He said, are you a Jehovah's Witness? I said, no. I'm a Bible-believing Christian. Hey, Bible-believing? What Bible you believe in? I said, well, I believe only the King James. And he grabbed my Bible and checked it out. I said, wait a second. And then started asking me all these different questions to see if I was really what I was portraying to be. And that's how we met.
Well, it's a small world, of course. I had met Dick Cave. We've talked a number of times, and he's put me in touch with other people. His passion is to find out what happened to the boys who were abandoned in Laos and Vietnam. And,
right.
And he's over there. He's been working there. He's actually been into the jungles many times, trying to, this is his goal in life. And
right.
Apparently there are other Americans over there, too. The American people have forgotten the boys we sent to Vietnam. We don't like to believe that our government would betray them,
right.
That Henry Kissinger would lie to the American people, and, of course, Richard Nixon would lie to the American people. And in fact, I've been told that Captain Red McDaniels, who was a longtime prisoner of the North Vietnamese and eventually was released, came back to America, and he went to see President Nixon after he was out of the White House and said, why did you lie to the American people? Why didn't you tell them the boys were abandoned? And Nixon said, oh, I meant to, and I was going to get them out, but then, of course, Watergate came along, and then I was out of power. And Richard Nixon never had the courage, even though he knew what had happened. He knew that Henry Kissinger had promised to give the Vietnamese some $3 or $4 billion to ransom the boys and bring them home. Richard Nixon never had the courage to tell the American people that. And so all of it, everything he did was a lie. Watergate was an incidental issue. Of course, this was a man who wasn't fit to lead because he was quite willing, like all so many of the other leaders we have, to lie, simply to create the perception he was a good man.
Right. And now just think about our brother Kay. He's over there. He's all alone. Nobody goes with him to these jungles. He goes there by himself. But he prays to God. He's not going in there using man's wisdom. He's not going there using man's means. He's going in there by faith in God and happens to run into me, a brother in the Lord.
Who
we
happens
meet
to
together,
know about Radio Liberty.
We meet together. Now we start talking about the Lord, about the Bible, and then we start sharing who we are. And then my dad happens to work for the U.S. government on this issue. Now, of course, my dad, being a government worker, soldier, he's really obedient to the government right now. He doesn't do anything himself yet, but he knows of lots of information to help people like our brother Kay out. And so he can give him all these information now to put brother Kay light years ahead of where he was with information-wise.
No, of course, as far as you're concerned, there really are some boys still over there in Laos, aren't there?
I don't know if they'd still be alive, which they could be, and they probably are. But yes, there's proof that they're left behind. They're going to be really old. And the sad thing, like Brother Kay and I both agree about, when you find them, they're not going to be, the lights will be on, but nobody's going to be home. They're going to be mentally destroyed, emotionally destroyed, mentally destroyed. They're going to be vegetables. Because it's been so many years.
Well, I think that we still have a moral obligation to try to bring them back. And I know that Kay and Kevin, who we've we've known for some time, and there are others over there, I know, who've given their lives in this search. The tragedy is this is totally blocked out by the controlled press. And certainly the CIA, which controls our media largely, does not want the American people to focus their attention on that any more than they want to ask why we abandoned Lieutenant Commander Spitzer, the naval pilot who was shot down in Iraq during the Gulf War.
Right, right.
Because, of course, if our fighting men realized that their comrades in arms would defend them and would come after them, but our leaders would not, because the forces of darkness have taken control of our government, at that point they would stop fighting. And, of course, they are using the America's military might and financial power to bring about this one-world government in preparation, in my estimation, for the coming of the Antichrist.
Right.
And that's why we're over in the Near East today, and this is going to precipitate World War III. This is what it's really all about.
Right, right.
Do you see that happening?
The hindrance to all this happening, of course, as we know, is us Christians here. People like Brother K, one man praying to God. He has two governments against him, and he can still get the information out. He can still find the stuff out. And people like ourselves who are still out there preaching, giving the truth out, we're the hindrance to all this, all to their plans right now. They've got to either take us out or we've got to be taken out.
Well, of course, if you run into Brother K again, I hope you'll give him my best and tell him to get in touch with me when he gets back here. And
definitely.
We'll
see him in a few days.
We'll put him on the radio. Now,
right.
Somebody had called and asked if you were to get a letter and a contribution sent to you in Thailand, would it get there safely, do you think?
The best way would be either to email me or write to me, if they don't have access to email, to write to me the address I gave. It takes about a week for a letter from the U.S. to get to me. Or email me, Case, is the best way, and then I can email back and we'll find the best way to do it. I have a U.S. bank account here in America, and I have an ATM card. So some way, some people can put money into the U.S. bank account if they contact me.
All right, fine. Well, let's get your email out again one more time. S-I-P-H, pray, Isu.
Right. Sit, pray, Isu. In Thai, that means disciple the Lord Jesus.
Okay. SITA@hotmail.com. And anybody who wants to get it, I can give us a call. And Herman's on the board, and he'll give you the email. And, of course, just spell that one more time.
S-I-T-H.
S-I-P, like P and Paul.
T as in Tony.
Oh, S-I-T-H, okay.
Right. P as in Paul.
Right.
R-A-Y-E-S-U.
At hotmail.com.
.com, right.
Okay, and that's Brother Tony Webb, a Post Office Box 20, S-U-T-T-H-I-S-A-N.
Right.
Bangkok, Thailand, 10321.
10321, that's right.
10321. Okay, yes, fine. If you anybody interested in getting in touch with him, or, of course, emailing him. And if you're, really, it's a unique sort of ministry. There are not very many people who do this, go off completely on their own. And, of course, just trust in the Lord to provide for them and for their family. Right. And do you have children as well?
Yes, I have two children. One daughter, her name is Esther. She's 2.5 years old. And my son, he's 1 year old today. His name is Mordecai.
Well, I guess you're anxious to get back over there then, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
Well, of course, I think it's a wonderful thing you're doing. And, you know, sometimes I wonder if I do 5 hours of talk radio a day, how many people we're really reaching? Because it's really not simply to entertain people, but it's to try to put things into a spiritual perspective, which we have the unique ability perhaps to understand that the battle is not a political battle or an ideological or cultural battle, but a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, economic, educational battlefield. And, of course, behind this is this eternal spiritual battle which has been going on since the beginning of time.
Right.
And I think that we are living in the most exciting time in recorded history right now, don't you?
Yes, I do. And the Bible says that they that know God shall be strong and do exploits. And as Brother Kay's example, or even my example here, preaching the gospel in the streets, we found our purpose that we believe God has called us to, and with the power of prayer of knowing God, not just praying a bunch of repetitious prayers, but you know, praying to God, actually knowing God, fellowshipping with God, having a time with God together, working together with God, we can do such great things for Him. And this is what's so great about living these last times. We're living a time I believe the apostles look forward to. And when we get to get, when we're going to get to heaven, they're going to ask us about these times we lived in and what it was like. To see all this prophecies and everything being fulfilled, like we're seeing it today.
Well, what are your parting thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners this evening, Tony?
Well, that was it. Just God said to call upon me, and I'll answer thee and show thee things thou knowest not. And I know people out there have heart's desires, such as Brother Kay or myself. We have a purpose in life, a desire in our heart to do things for God, or to do things for others. We believe God's called us to. And the whole trick is that time of prayer and working with God. And it can do just, God can just do great things through us in these last times.
Well, God bless you that when you get back over here again,
yes.
Why, please give us a call. We'd love
okay,
to
God bless you. I'll keep in touch with the emails. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay, God bless you. Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. That was Brother Tony, and of course, Tony Webb from Thailand, who simply lives on faith and is out every day, of course, preaching for the Lord. And, you know, when you see people, and I know others who simply live totally on faith, and this is just illogical in our world today. I mean, we've got to look after ourselves, and yet, of course, as the Lord said, I mean, certainly the Lord will look after you. As He and His disciples went out, and, of course, He told them that, you know, their job was to follow the Lord. The Lord would provide. And the Lord did provide for them. So I think it's a sort of story, it's a heartwarming story that I wanted you to hear tonight. So it's been sort of an interesting evening. I hope you've enjoyed it. But I believe exactly what I said earlier. I believe that we are living in the end times. Now, of course, people have said that since the beginning of time, but everything is in place now as never before. Never before in all recorded history has there been the ability to have a monetary system, a cashless monetary system. Never before has there been the ability to put a chip into people so you can't either buy or sell, unless, of course, you wear the mark of the beast or known by the number of his name. Never before has there been the effort to bring everybody into a world government with a world leader. Never before in recent history of the Jews been returned to the Holy Land, and we could go down the list of the prophecies that are recorded in the scriptures, and of course you see that so many of them coming together just in times like these. So, you know, if you read Ezekiel 38 and 39, and of course read Ezekiel 39 and verse 6 about what befalls of the island, the distant island, at the time of that Ezekiel is describing. And, of course, pray for America, because understand, I believe that God is using what's happening now to bring judgment on America, as He's done with every other nation, but especially this one that has had so much wealth and prosperity and freedom that nobody else in modern times has ever enjoyed. We've enjoyed here in America. And what have the American people done? What has the American church done? Why, we've simply turned our back on God and on God's message and the concept that we were created equal and endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. Why, they won't even teach that in our schools today. And certainly our leaders won't acknowledge that. And they've all adopted the fact that there's a wall of separation between church and state. And it would be, of course, unpatriotic and un-American to talk about God. Well, we're out of time. And so, of course, until tomorrow at the same time,